I'm Andrew Richardson, and welcome to this fourth of the Action Audios. I've called it Attention and Tips. This is a catch-all where I round up everything that I have not spent too much, if any, time on before the final audio in this series, and indeed what many will be the final audio of this entire program of depression recovery. You will be feeling a lot better, I sincerely hope, and ready to get your life really working better by using your emotional resources, which will now be in much better shape in support of getting your essential needs better met. And if this depression recovery program series has not helped you, or not very much, then truly I am sorry. And in this audio, I will also be detailing why that might be, which I hope will give you some comfort, and perhaps this may help you get something from the program and give you something for the future. Now, there is, of course, a big industry of depression tips and advice. And if you go to official medical sources for help, you will find a lot of weight put on either cognitive behavioral therapy, that's CBT, or medication as the routes to recovery. And now mindfulness and meditation is becoming popular. And this is amazingly enough, even with official sanction. But perhaps you have come to this program as refugees from a lot of this. So what is going on? Well, this is my take. But before I begin, let me say that this audio has a different tone and purpose to all of the others. It is didactic and a little polemical, opinionated even. My opinion, of course. And what I'm doing is stating my opinion of what is, rather than directly influencing and healing you. So here goes. Well, consider if you are teaching chess to a complete beginner. You would not start by teaching the rules governing how each of the chess pieces move, the pawn, the bishop, the castle, and so on. No, you would state what the objective of the game was, namely to checkmate the opposing king. Yes, you would need to teach the moves early on, and it would be very important that a chess beginner had fully mastered them. But the mastering of the moves comes second to knowing what is actually going on in the game. And of course, and this is the really important point, that to know what is the purpose of the game will then make the learning of the moves much easier. And so it is with depression tips and medical type advice and interventions. There is a mountain of information and sources that makes pretty sensible points about what might help to relieve a depression. But if you have no idea about what actually is the cause of these awful depression experiences and why they seem to be getting worse whatever you do, well, all of these tips and ideas will fall well short of what is needed. And what are the tips that you will find in pretty well every depression help source? Let's start with regular exercise and the eating of nutritious food and the cutting down of sugars and heavily processed food. Well, there's no doubt that these are good things to do. And the more depressed people find that they can focus on simple tasks or manage to get out in the community, even if it is the last thing they want to do, then this can be pretty helpful too. And there are many websites that will say this, and I for one would never argue against any of it. Laughing is good, and my favourite, the cultivation of a practice of daily gratitude. These are all good. But on their own, they are just not enough. Like Hungarian goulash without the paprika. Something is missing. And what is it that's missing in all of this? It is a clear explanation and understanding of what a depression is. Namely, the exhaustion caused by worrying too much and hence engaging in far too much high-energy dreaming. But you know that now, don't you? And you will know more than most of them, including the experts, so-called. The same goes for meditation, the enthusiasm of which has matured nicely over the years, such that it is now an official recommendation for healing from depression. And what could be more impressive and worthwhile than that? The appeal to professionals is clear, First, there is academic credibility, as Professor Davidson of the University of Wisconsin has done some excellent work to show how meditation can change brain function, especially as it might impact on those suffering with depression. And the authorities just love that kind of thing. They don't like to rely on a bunch of Buddhists and other slightly questionable types. And many others have got in on the act, of which perhaps the best known is Jon Kabat-Zinn, who has written extensively on how meditation and mindfulness practices can help to relieve depression and anxiety problems. Indeed, he seems to have single-handedly created a new industry of meditation for depression. And on one level, all of this is good. I certainly would never argue that meditation for depression and mindfulness practices are a bad thing to do, or that there are not in principle major benefits in distancing yourself from high emotion and gain a better understanding and control of emotions. And of the hundreds of depressed and anxious clients I have helped, maybe 10 have found a meditation practice to be helpful, and rather more have used mindfulness, though for all, it's only towards the end of our time together, when they were already feeling much better. And that's the point. Just as you would never recommend someone with arthritis to begin a marathon training program, or someone who is interested in beginning some DIY to build and install a kitchen from scratch, there are far easier and reliable ways to help someone who is depressed than meditation. Indeed, it risks doing far more harm than good, as for most who are depressed, it will be just too darn difficult. And the fact that they seem to be so popular and pushed so hard reveals a lot about the monumental scale of ignorance out there of what a depression actually is and how best to clear it. And neither is conventional talking therapies normally the right thing. This is because talking about your problems and saying how you feel is not the best thing for a depressed person, even if they mistakenly think it is, as their emotions have to be calmed down first before it makes any sense. Talking will just maintain arousal and does not point to solutions and changes that can work. And if you are being asked to talk about your feelings, overwhelming and chaotic and unordered and inescapable as they are, by someone trained to listen, well, how scary is that? And you know that, don't you? And if you do go to your doctor, depressed and mentally exhausted, the chances are that you will be offered either antidepressants of some kind or cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. And by having these two on offer, one could be forgiven for thinking that this is a choice between two effective and proven depression treatments. But actually, neither is much cop. For example, this is what Amanda wrote to me about her CBT course. Amanda is from Illinois. I did cognitive behavioral therapy. It had limited success as it worked for a while. However, I find myself so tense all the time from having to evaluate every single thought I had 24 hours a day, every day. Eventually, my defenses would wear down and I would relax, and then I would slip right back into depression again. It was defeating and killing my hope. They never understood that once that feeling stabbed me, I was done for, and my ability to think clearly and rationally disappeared. So CBT couldn't help me then. Before, sure, after the switch, never. So that's what you found? I'm not saying that to challenge negative thoughts does not have its place, but emotions come first. CBT is rarely the answer because it is about challenging thoughts. It's about changing how you think. It's about breaking down complex thoughts and behaviors that are keeping you stuck. It is about facing up to clearly unhelpful black and white thoughts, such as I am stupid and people hate me and I cannot do anything about this and for the rest of my life I am doomed and so on. But feelings come first, especially feelings of exhaustion and the terror of not knowing why you are feeling so bad and depressed, because you have no idea why you are lost in a vicious cycle of tiredness and useless rumination. And in these circumstances, and knowing that, why would you think for a minute that someone trained in CBT would have any idea at all of what to do for you? Well, maybe a little bit, but no more useful than a pea shooter attempting to down an elephant. At least that's what I think. And now, what can be said about antidepressants, the use of which is expanding exponentially in the West and reaching massive numbers? 50 million subscriptions annually in the UK now, for example. The Human Givens Institute summarizes the evidence on antidepressants. This is what they say: that antidepressants work in aggregate about as well as placebo, which means that about one third of people benefit. But of course, they do not pretend to treat the root cause, and so there is a high rate of relapse, and a quarter of users will do less well than placebo. And there are side effects, from an increased suicide risk, loss of sex drive, dizziness, nausea, fatigue, headaches, and so on. Finally, the Institute says that the evidence is that a third of those taking antidepressants will suffer withdrawal symptoms. So that's not impressive. And if you ask GPs for their private views on antidepressants, and this has been surveyed, then they are not that impressed either. And the idea of a chemical imbalance is also unproven. Thus, the gut, which may be thought of as a second brain, will also generate serotonin. But this does not mean chemistry is the cause. It is actually much more complex, and the causal effects are probably the other way round. You feel bad, and you generate more serotonin. It's a crapshoot, if truth be told. Antidepressants could help you, but then again, they might not. You may have side effects, or you might be lucky. You might have withdrawal effects, or you might not. But as I hope I have demonstrated to you, there are better ways to overcome your depression. Okay, now I want to say something about why it might be that this program has not helped you. It will be just for a small proportion, but of course, if you are one of these, that is scarcely any comfort. In any event, this is my list of reasons as I ponder those depressed individuals who came to me and who did not feel any better. I can split them into 5 categories. First, there are the secondary gainers. These have a purpose or gain to maintain their depression, and it manifests as a powerful resistance to change. It is a very small group in my experience. I have to admit to a great reluctance to believe that there are many in this category, as if you are not careful, the secondary gainers can include all of those who do not respond to your treatment. In other words, it's their fault and not yours. Then second, it can reflect circumstances. These are heartbreaking, as we are talking of those where life circumstances seem so bad and intractable that it appears impossible that a life can be created where fundamental human needs can be met. Not only that, but by any movement in the right direction, it appears impossible. Also, because current circumstances are so difficult and recent history has been so negative. We are talking of poverty and loneliness and an absence of work and meaning where truly hope has been extinguished. And the third reason is patterns. That's what I call it. From time to time, I have clients where I expect recovery to take place, but it just does not happen. These clients have resources and a history where they're certainly has been success based on initiating change, but this time the problem appears intractable, and however hard they have tried and however creative and optimistic I am, the current situation is one of complete stuckness. It typically manifests as an external problem around work or a relationship, but there is a failure to change. Often these clients engage very well with me, but then give up, believing either that I cannot help or that anyone can help. It is immensely frustrating for us both. The fourth reason is failure on my part, Are there circumstances where I can clearly see that the failure is mine? Of course I can. If one was unkind, you might say that some of those pattern failures in the previous set must surely reflect me, and indeed that may have been so. But sometimes my failure is more obvious than that. A failure by me to engage and build rapport, to offer a way forward that my client is happy to take, or a complete failure by me to even get to first base. All I can say is that these cases are mercifully rare, and I will find that there are lessons for me to learn. Indeed, you could say that the difference between 3 and 4 here are that for 3, I can find no lessons. And finally and fifthly, chemistry. These are the cases where there does seem to be a chemical and biological factor at work, which I'm willing to concede require something more, at least in part, than I can offer. Sometimes this involves sleep problems, sometimes physical problems, while at other times I do find mood and anxiety swings that I cannot otherwise explain. But again, this is rare. Well, I hope this helps and that it does make some sense. And now I want to talk of 2 other factors around our common psychology that I have not yet mentioned and which could either be contributing to persistent difficulties you are experiencing and you should certainly be aware of before the next final audio of this action suite. I'm talking of our need for the right kind of privacy and the giving and receiving of attention. First, privacy, which is an essential emotional human need according to the human givens. And I have been reminded of this by my experience recently with an extremely depressed client I will call F. Her suffering could be understood as entirely driven by a complete absence of any privacy at all. And what was interesting was that it was not privacy in the obvious sense, as she certainly had space in which she could be alone and which she could keep her things. No, for F, it was that she had no place that she could go to or even be in that felt at all safe, where she could allow herself the time to begin to process and to daydream. F's family viewed her as dangerous and mad, even, and she had literally no place to turn to for any sense of safety at all. For her, the complete absence of any privacy was about being emotionally unsafe and threatened, so always either watchful or running away. And it occurred to me while listening to F that being profoundly unsafe meant a complete absence of any privacy. And this was the simplest description that one could find for what depression is. There seems no possibility of escape to a safe place, and so it was impossible to be private enough to allow time to process and quieten down and see things differently. Depression is being lost in a never-ending nightmare and unable ever to escape. And now attention. The giving and receiving of attention is not on everyone's list of essential emotional needs. We can understand the need to be safe, to have some control of our lives, to have meaningful relationships and a sense of meaning. But attention, what is that exactly? To my mind, the best way to understand it, both the giving and receiving of attention, is to understand that it is about self-referencing and learning in the most profound sense. It's about checking and learning about oneself in the easiest way possible, which is with reference to what is happening outside of us. It is only by watching and observing others and what they say and do, and by testing our own thoughts and emotions and actions by the reaction of others, that we in fact learn in the most fundamental sense about what is appropriate and best for us. It is absolutely essential for our survival. And if we find that our attention exchanges are limited to a very narrow group, then this will mean that our capacity to live a life that works can be seriously compromised. I got a magnificent example of this from my early days as a therapist when I saw a young depressed university student. Eventually, I asked her about her friends at university, and she said they were all like her, not working, staying up late, and drug taking. I remember saying to her that she needed to find new friends, ones that could give her a much better model of living, that she could observe them and they could, by their reaction to her, push her to live a life that worked better. And that was exactly what she needed. Now imagine a life where there is no meaningful attention exchange at all, where no one recognizes or not acknowledges you, where you are viewed as either mad or useless, and where nothing you say is heard at all. And so you respond by disappearing from view. Can you imagine that? It would be as if you were losing all meaningful contact with the world. It would be like being lost in space with no sensory contact possible. It would be as if you ceased to exist. Maybe that is madness. So you must be attending to and meeting and relating to a wide group of people. And it has to be varied. And to have enough time to process what has been happening to you. And of course, depressed people often have too much time on their own, which is lost in repetitive rumination and high arousal. This is not the same as high quality and safe processing, calmly and unhurriedly. And that can be where mindfulness and meditation can be useful. But there are so many ways to be calmer and to have gentle focus, which then allows your unconscious mind to process and get ready to be active again. I will stop there. I've covered a lot, and I hope my remarks have not been too controversial. They are very much the conclusions of my experience as a depression recovery expert over many years. And the next audio is the final audio of the depression recovery program, putting it all together in what I hope is a useful way to be better living a life that works. Thank you.